Hello, everybody. I'm talking to you for the first time after getting my eyes operated on. Everybody assumes it's for cataracts, but it's in fact simply because I was so myopic that with this laser surgery, giving you the ability to be able to see clearly at a distance, I thought it would be great to be able to see my audience and not just sort of see this vague blur. And it's also great for me right now because I can see the camera. And although I don't see you specifically, I sort of feel more as if I were seeing you through the camera. In fact, today I have a number of people here from our staff at Ananda. Yesterday I had the Italian-speaking group, and today I have the English-speaking group. And the overlaps who prefer to talk in English to talking in Italian, or maybe are equally good at both but found it easier to come today. Anyway, on behalf of all of them, I wanted to say hello to you. We've been passing through an unusually difficult time, as you all know. And certainly to all of you who are familiar with the difficulties we've had, the question has come up, why? Why would we have to go through it? People think in terms of karma. Of course, everything is karma. And one can accept that I may have had this karma, but that a whole group of people should have had this karma. What kind of karma in God's name would do it? We've lived an extremely dharmic life. We have never tried to take from others. We've always tried to think what was well and what was best for everybody. In fact, even during the fire in 1976, when it was the fire destroyed almost all our homes, and it was discovered that the fire was caused by a faulty spark arrestor on a county vehicle. And our neighbors were all excited because they said, we can sue the county and get all our money back. And some people were saying, yeah, we could get $2 million. That would have been enough not only to rebuild the houses at that time, but to build the entire community. And I wrote the county supervisors a letter, and I said that we don't want to take our hard luck out on others. If we, for example, I didn't express it this way, but if we had sued the county for $2 million, the county taxes would have had to be raised to pay the higher premium on the insurance. It would have hurt everybody. And as I wrote to them, I said, we don't want to take our hard luck out on our neighbors, so we will not be suing. And it meant the very strong probability, viewed from a worldly point of view, that we would simply fail as a community. I felt that was a worthwhile price to pay to remain dharmic. And no, we didn't have the money to rebuild. We didn't have the money to survive. A number of people felt that this was just too much of a test finally, and they left. And so we felt that whatever people sent in the way of donations, we would pay them off first, rather than say, well, you have an equal right to be repaid as we have to rebuild, but we want to rebuild first and then we'll pay you. It would have been a perfectly logical thing and nothing wrong with it, but it didn't feel right. And so we paid them and had to rebuild out of the scraps. And we went on a cross-country tour, a couple of cross-country tours. And with all of that, bit by bit, because we believed in what we have, because we loved what we have, we were able to rebuild and to become stronger than ever. And in fact, the fire turned out to be a great blessing in many ways. Well, again, you can say, were we a community in some other incarnation together? Did we burn down some rival village and so on? That's a perfectly logical way of thinking, but it isn't true. It isn't the truth in this situation. And yet, I mean, how do I know? Do I know all those past lives? No, I don't, but I just don't feel that it's right. There's something more involved here. You know, if you read the Indian scriptures, they're full of stories of people who did tapasya or went through severe austerity, not to pay as a penance for their past sins, but yes, to wipe the slate clean, of course, but really to develop some sort of divine power, some sort of divine grace. Swami Vivekananda put it beautifully that with austerity, it's like a cannonball hitting a wall. And although the cannonball is stopped, its motion is stopped by the strength of that wall, there's a great heat that's generated by that impact. And similarly, when any particular line of development is prevented from continuing, either by force or by choice, it generates energy in some other way, because energy cannot be destroyed. Whenever you go through suffering, penance, persecution, or deprivation of any kind, that, yes, on the one hand, it does wipe the slate clean, you become a little purer, you become a little more free, all of that. But as a specific goal, it develops within you, it generates within you a power to accomplish great things. Now, when I was thrown out of SRF, to me it seemed like the greatest possible tragedy. I dedicated my whole life to that. I had nothing else to live for. I didn't believe in anything else. I couldn't. I know I lived for 6 months in a Catholic monastery, but I couldn't get over the feeling, but this isn't serving Master's cause. And I couldn't live there as they wanted me to. And it was a good thing to do, but I just couldn't do it. It wasn't just God I was serving, it was my guru. And my guru had come with a mission. And my life was dedicated to fulfilling that mission. So, in fact, the dismissal that I went through and the suffering that I went through then, when I have to admit I felt abandoned for a while, even by my guru, it was a much greater test than this later test that we've gone through. And certainly I did ask myself again and again, why? But what I've seen over the years has been that it generated a power that I wouldn't have had otherwise, and I know I wouldn't have had it. Roger, she said, Master has a great work to do through you, and he will give you the power to do it. But I didn't have that power then, and it did come to me gradually. I remember Sant Keshav Das visiting Ananda once, and he said, what tapasya you had to go through to make this place possible. And yes, it was definitely true on many levels, but it was true also on this level, that dismissal, that force that made it impossible for me to serve my guru in the way that I myself believed was the only way, made it possible for me to build Ananda, made it possible for me to write all these books, made it possible for me to write music, made it possible, in the sense of freeing me, to do things that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise, but it was more than freeing me. It also generated a power that made it possible for all of you to live for Master, to serve Master in a way that I don't think many of you would have done if Ananda didn't exist. I know that countless numbers of you have come to me and said that you wouldn't have felt attracted to Master through SRF. You would have loved him on your own, but you wouldn't have wanted to join that work. It wasn't your ray, in a way. What Master has given me is a ray that brought Ananda into existence, that generated the kind of magnetism that you feel comfortable with. And thus, through this suffering that I went through then, and believe me, it was intense, yet I have to say that great blessings have come, and I'm only grateful for it. I don't resent anything. People say, well, the way you've treated them, why do you love them? Well, I said earlier today to all of the people here that I love them partly because there's no fun not loving. There's joy in loving, but It's also that I have nothing to be bitter about. It's given me so much. Now, you've all been brought into the same act. I have to admit that when this thing came, this newest lawsuit came on, my thought repeatedly was, could Master possibly, he couldn't want me to suffer twice in the same way. And yet he did. And yet it wasn't the same. And it wasn't the same partly because all of you were brought in on it too. And whereas I'm deeply sorry that you had to do this, it was your karma as well as mine, but not bad karma. That's the beauty of it. It's your tapasya because, and I deeply and firmly believe this, Ananda has a much greater role to play than it has been able to play so far. And you've needed to gain the strength. You've needed to do the austerity, to go through the persecution and the injustice and all the pain that this has brought upon you in order to make you strong enough, because I think the world is going to go through a great deal of suffering. And when people can see that here is a community that everybody has tried to destroy and yet they're stronger than ever, they're going to say, what have they got that we need? And how can we survive in these hard times? Well, by that example, we can live together with others. We can work together with others. We can pool our strength with others. And only in that way will we have the strength to survive. I believe that this will be a part of Ananda's role in the future. And that you've had to be the scapegoat, you might say. But it has been for a divine purpose. And it has been a divine play. You know, it's just been incredible to me. And this has been probably for me the real test. Seeing quite, it was too obvious that God's hand was behind this persecution we've gone through. Every break that could easily have gone in our direction, logic demanded that it go in our direction, and yet it went against us. There was no reason why certain decisions by the judge, certain circumstances, certain coincidences, no reason why it had to happen the way it did. And yet again and again, God withheld his hand when he could so easily have performed just the miracles he's performed again and again to ensure Ananda's survival and thriving. And I thought, well, why would he withhold his hand now? I thought, do you want this? If you don't, then you really owe it to us to do something to show that you're on our side. Nope, nothing. The most recent thing was a decision that came down from the court in Nevada City, which I thought, well, certainly that one. It's just too obvious that it's on the truth is on our side. And yet it didn't turn against us. It just didn't give us anything. I thought, God, you could so easily have done it. Why didn't you? And so it's not that I complain. I don't blame God. He knows what he's doing. He's running this whole universe. I have a hard time enough running my own little life. But I did want to understand. I thought, well, why? And I realize now that why is that he wanted us to gain the strength. Ananda's already much stronger than it was. Here in Italy, people hadn't really felt it very much. But among you all in America, it's been quite a test, especially in Palo Alto and at Ananda Village. And we've lost a number of people. This has happened again and again through Ananda's history, that certain people just felt, well, this is too much or this isn't for me. But the result of it has been that the people who have remained, which is certainly the vast majority, are more dedicated, more certain, more sure of what they're doing. And all the word that I get back from America is that things are thriving. Palo Alto, which had to suffer the most in terms of the press, totally unfair and untrue, but repeated condemnation of us, mockery of us, holding us up to the light of public ridicule and judgment. I remember when they were selecting the jury, and they had to go through some hundred and quite a few people just to select the jury that at least would not say that they wouldn't sit there and judge us beforehand. They judged us anyway. But there was this one woman who confessed that she just wouldn't be able to not judge us. And so they excused her. And I remember as she was walking out, she looked at me and she said, "Oh!" Like this, as if, "Oh, you vile, evil creature. How can you be allowed to live?" kind of thing. And I just smiled back at her. What did it matter what she thought? But Palo Alto has had to go through a lot of that. And yet now I just talked with Asha and David this morning, and it's doing better than ever. They put on a school play recently, and she said she was so proud of those children. She said that nobody would believe that children could act as well and as gracefully and graciously as those children did. She said it was just wonderful. And I said, I think that the school in Palo Alto has a much greater possibility than the school in Ananda Village or in the other places, because Palo Alto is so much the hub of a great deal of intellectual activity in America, Silicon Valley and all of that. And it's so close to things, whereas the village is a long way away. The other schools in Portland and Sacramento are doing beautifully, but Palo Alto is more developed and more concentrated. I said, from here, I think that this ideal of education for life can really spread. But we have so many things to offer people. God doesn't stint himself when it comes to truth. He doesn't say that truth is locked up in a monastery. He doesn't say truth is locked up in prayer and meditation. Truth is something that needs to be expressed now, especially in this new Dwapara Yuga, on all levels, in school, in work, in business, in family. I read an absolutely wonderful book recently. Somebody gave it to me a few years ago, and I haven't gotten around to reading it just because the moment hadn't come. But in the hospital, it was a perfect opportunity. I was surrounded by a great deal of other kinds of vibrations, so I just sort of closed myself in my little cocoon of thinking about God, and I read this book. It's by Glenn Clark, but it's about the life of Walter Thomas. I think that's his name. Gads, I might have it wrong. Anyway, it's the man must have been a great yogi. He was uneducated, basically. He had to quit school at the age of 10 because he had to help to support his family. But he said that was one of the greatest blessings he'd ever had, because he didn't learn the formal way of doing things. So he never learned the normal encyclopedic education that people get who go through formal schooling, nor did he learn any of the fields that he became proficient in. He became a really great sculptor and artist. His eyes, he said, most sculptors, when they do eyes, they just sort of put orbs in there. It's that they think only physically. But the soul of a person shows through his eyes. And so you see the eyes of his sculptures, and every one of them looks like a real individual. You can feel the personality behind it. And he never studied art. He wrote music and never studied music. There was one piece that years later, Paderewski, the most famous pianist at his time, this is at the beginning of the century, asked him to play, and it was recorded. And he was extremely successful as an architect and very successful in everything that he did. In fact, that was a period in America that is really quite astounding. It produced some great men, and men who all had this attitude of service. Andrew Carnegie was, I think, one such, but Frank Laubach, whose book you all know, Letters by a Modern Mystic, Rufus Jones, he's Glenn Clark, the author of this book, put at the top, of the list, and I thought, my God, I knew Rufus Jones, and I didn't get that out of him. What blindness on my part to miss that opportunity. But he was at Haverford College when I was there. He'd retired. But my only contact with Rufus Jones, unfortunately, to my discredit, was that I accepted the job of mowing their lawn one day. And I used to have a habit of just singing loudly wherever I was, walking through the streets of the city and whatever. And so there I was mowing the lawn and singing away, and his wife opened the door and said, "Would I please tone it down?" And yet, but there were so many others, George Washington Carver. In fact, Glenn Clark wrote another beautiful book about him. But there have been a number of Dale Carnegie, did I mention him? A number of people with this. Well, this man, Walter Russell, that's his name. I knew Thomas wasn't right. Walter Russell. Everything he did, he decided that the real power to do it is not in the information. Just, it's so thrilling to read these things, even if you've been saying it to people for a long time. But it doesn't come from information, it doesn't come from study, it doesn't come from learning how other people do it all that much, but just to get into the consciousness. He says, all knowledge is so simple. All you have to do is get close to the heart of the infinite. And from that, everything is available to you. And one thing that he did that astounded me, just perhaps more than anything else, although it doesn't seem nearly so important as the writings, the philosophy, the art, the sculpture, the music, the everything, was skating. He took up figure skating and decided that he'd really learn, so he got some top-notch teachers to teach him all the ways to figure skate. You can't really come up with that just entirely on your own. But do you know that at the age of 69, he entered into competition with three or four other young people, experts in their field, and it was a competition with a prize. Do you know he won that prize at the age of 69? Well, that's not much younger than I am, and I think, God, if I could stand up on skates, I'd feel pretty good. But the point is that the more we can learn to get at the center of truth, the more we find that everything we do is, we can do it well. And this has been one of the things that Ananda is doing. The same with Education for Life. It's perfectly simple, but you get to the heart of it, and suddenly you see that you can teach in a new way, reach children in a new way, and make children themselves accomplish things that grown-ups would say, oh, well, you can't expect children to do that. But they do. They have done it. They did it last night. Well, these are examples only of what Ananda has to bring to others. And having gone through all that persecution, I felt myself that, gosh, twice in my life my hands have been completely tied. There wasn't anything I could do about it. I remember when I was thrown out of SRF, I was 12,000 miles away in India. I'd had no part in that decision, and yet it was made for me. I could do nothing about it. I was called to New York, so I would be as far away from the scene of action as possible. And Tara gave me this long diatribe about all the evils that I was guilty of, and I knew they weren't true, and I started to try to say, but this is just not so. She said, I don't need your opinions. Well, that's as far as I got, and in the court it was just the same way. Once I tried to say something, and Flynn sarcastically said, oh yes, we know, Mr. Walters, you like to be eloquent. Well, the guy had been eloquent, so-called eloquent, for a month or more, and I couldn't even speak at all. I tried once to say to Gordon Rockhill, our lawyer, when his impassioned plea in our defense was, objection, Your Honor. That's about the most we got out of him. He was the worst lawyer we could have had for our case, a great lawyer. But I had said from the beginning, this is not the right man. And yet I was voted down, so I just accepted it as God's will. But he said it so softly that I couldn't really hear him. And I said, Gordon, could you please speak louder? The judge jumped on me, said, I'll ask the questions in this court. Do you hear me, soldiers? And I said, okay, let it go. Might as well relax and enjoy. And I had my hands completely tied. And yet, that power comes out in other ways. It has come out here. We were helpless. People would get up there on the stand and get mocked for being honorable and truthful and noble. And the jury, somehow they decided that because our people were so calm, they'd been brainwashed. What can you do when you're surrounded by crocodiles? Nothing, just try to get out of their way. Hope they snap at each other. But look what's come. Ananda has become strong. Remember that the persecution, because everybody, we don't do these exaggerated practices like the sadhus who raise their hands above their heads and keep them that way for years, and the arms become shriveled, and you feel that it's just a fanatical way to behave. And Master didn't recommend it. Buddha said it was not a good thing. And yet, there is still something to be said for it. And whether we don't, even if we don't deliberately go through these extreme penances, nonetheless, persecution is a part of the path. It's not as if God just sort of cleared the brambles from before your feet as you walk. Rather, he seems to throw them in the way. So you'll be sure to get stuck. There's a reason for it. You can't grow in God consciousness if you don't go through a cleansing. If you don't have that cannonball of your own enthusiasm be blocked again and again by the walls of worldly indifference and worldly misunderstanding. Master said you can't get rid, you can't overcome that. As Master one time also said to me when I asked him, by the way, don't do that, please. When I asked him, I was going through something or other there, and I asked Master, and he just dismissed it impatiently. Almost impatiently, he wasn't an impatient man, but brusquely, let's say. He said, living for God is martyrdom. I'd expected some sort of explanation or consolation or something. No, nothing, just that. Because it is. We have to learn that if we want to grow, as he used to say, a boxer doesn't become strong by boxing babies. He has to box other strong, good boxers and become better than they. One of the things that people don't understand in this day and age is spiritual as opposed to mundane astrology. I mean, not astrology, psychology. In the worldly eyes, we are the product of our environment. Psychologists, many of them, I think, generally speaking, in fact, have the idea that you're born an empty slate and your environment writes your destiny or your whatever you are to become, your personality, on that slate according to how you grow up. I don't know how psychologists can have that dogma. It's amazing how the intellect can interfere with your common sense. Most of them are married, most of them have children, most of them in raising their children see obviously before them the vast differences that exist among their babies from birth. Each baby is born a person in himself. I know when my nephew was born, he was still in his cradle, and I looked into his eyes and I knew. Right then, I knew that he'd become interested in spiritual teachings. And in fact, he has become. Now he's 42. But it's right there. You come trailing clouds. Well, Wordsworth put it kindly when he said clouds of glory. You trail all kinds of clouds. But the personality that you are, the person that you are, is well developed. Just like that story of Master when he picked up a baby one time that somebody gave him to hold. And he said, I almost dropped it because I saw that in that baby was a murderer. From the past, whether he'd murder in this life or not, I don't know. I don't know whether he meant that, but that this baby had committed murder before. And you'd see that little baby and you think, oh, the innocent, they're not all that innocent. And you get behind the appearance and you see that they're just playing their role. In fact, Lakshmi one time was trying to toilet train her little boy Yogesh, and Colin, he's called now, has reached his mature dignity. He said, come on now, you're not a baby any longer. And he looked up at her with a big smile. He said, but I like being a baby. We play our roles, but they're only roles. We are who we are, and we develop our personality not because the environment we live in imposes that personality on us, but because whatever environment we go through, our reaction to it develops us. And so we do change over the years, but not because of what's happened. Some people have been brought up in slums, have become great people. Other people have been brought up with all opportunities and have become nothing but bums, drunkards, lazy people, washouts. How you respond to life is what's important. When I was on that tour, which I took through the fjords of Norway, mainly because Warner Books had told me they wanted to send me on a nationwide tour to promote my book, Secrets of Life. And I had told them, I don't know that my heart will take it, but it seemed to be what was a part of the necessary thing. And so I thought, well, I'm going to have to really get a good rest before it. And so I went on this tour. I called it cruise, I meant, and through the fjords. And in fact, the tour did nearly kill me. It's why I ended up having to have my valve operated on and changed and so on. But anyway, what I'm remembering at the moment is that on this cruise, I was sitting with an old retired man who was a psychologist from New York, and we were talking about life, and he asked me what I did, and I told him about Ananda and so on. He said, well, what do you do for people? How do you work with people? And I said, well, we try to get people to not blame anyone, but to learn to stand on their own feet and see what they can do in themselves to change themselves, not worry about how their mother or their father or whoever else treated them when they were young, but what can they do about it themselves? This man looked at me in astonishment and he said, well, so, you're the opposition. Well, I said, yes, and I'm proud of it. Because in truth, the psychology today is based much too much on your helplessness as an individual before the onslaughts of an environment over which you have no control. And more it has been slipping into something, and Ram Bhakta sent me a very interesting excerpt, two excerpts from a book on the fallacies of much of modern psychology. I myself am not particularly in tune with the author, who seems to believe in other kinds of psychology that I don't believe in either. Like, for example, B.F. Skinner's behavioral psychology. I remember in his B.F. Skinner's book, Walden 2, he was sitting up there on a mountaintop and looking down at this community that he's formed, and the last words in the book were something like, what fun it is to play God, create this environment to make other people different people, You don't really change people by what you do to them. They change themselves. And if what you say helps them, it's because they've responded to it. It's not your credit. And if they react against it, again, it's their issue. It's not your issue. Each one of us has to develop himself. But psychology has become more and more sort of a pop kind of thing. It's so easy, and this is what the book that Ram Bhakta was quoting from seems to stress. It's such a simplistic view of psychology to say that you are a victim, and whatever happens to you, you're the victim. And therefore, of course, you're free to blame everybody. I think probably the best way a young woman can make a killing is to join a firm, accuse somebody of raping her, or trying to, collect her $80 million and retire to the Bahamas for life. I mean, we've reached a ridiculous situation in life where by blaming others, we think we gain. Of course, we lose terribly because we make ourselves all the more victims. I've often thought that beggars get bad karma by begging because they're only taking, they're only absorbing, they're not giving back. Far better sell pencil on a street corner. Some of the beggars in Calcutta, they've offered them jobs and they've taken the jobs for 1 or 2 days and quit and said, we can earn much more begging. But far more honorable to earn less and earn it by giving, by doing your part. These people simply are in what Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita described as a downward spiral. And they'll just go down and down and down until finally they decide they don't want to go down any further and they decide to turn around. But it all comes back to you. Yogananda wrote in his book on the interpretations of the Gita that it's possible to keep falling below the human level and so far down even on the evolutionary scale that you can become, and many souls do end up as germs, believe it or not. He said that many of the epidemics in this world are clouds of germs, fallen souls coming here to be punished by medicine and different things that would destroy them. But what a terrible fate to have to climb up from that level of nescience back to the human level and back through the human level to the upper level. Oh yes, it's a long process. But the wonderful thing about the teachings of Hinduism, and you don't find it really in any other religion. In Christianity they offer you salvation, but it's a salvation of such a limited order, when the saints go marching in. I can imagine these saints marching into heaven. It just implies a state of consciousness that is far from divine. Sort of, well, we've made it, boys, okay. And then you look at the Sistine Chapel, and the Last Judgment there, and God there with his arm like this, just ready to, with a great feeling, expression of rage as he condemns the sinners. And the Buddhists who have this idea that the only thing to do in life is hope for a better life next time so you won't end up being a spider. And probably many of them do believe that you probably will be a human being. Master said, once you reach the human level, it's not that easy to fall. And even if you fall to an animal level, because you've lived such an animalistic life, it'll only be for one life. And it's only if you go on that way that you get thrown further down and can be thrown even as low as a germ. But basically, once you've reached the human level, you are likely to go on growing that way. But the beautiful thing about Hinduism is that it says, look, you don't have to go on. You can achieve liberation from this great cycle of rebirth. Don't talk about getting good karma and getting a better life next time. Talk about getting out of it now. That's what's so wonderful about Kriya Yoga, that it teaches you that you can get out even in this lifetime. And Master said that you should at least aspire to be a Jivan Mukta in this lifetime, which is to say, freed from ego, freed from limitation. Be a saint, even like Ananda Bhoyima and Ramana Maharshi and other great saints that Master writes about in, he didn't write about Ramana Maharshi, but others, in Autobiography of a Yogi. So we need to keep our goal on the highest, and we need to know that to achieve that, it comes from us. The highest kind of psychology, to me, psychology is almost kindergarten stuff compared to what yoga gives you. And I don't mean to negate it. Just as I say that I think that many people 100 years from now will look back on modern medicine and equate it with shamanism, in the sense that it's so primitive. It's treating the body as if it were just a machine. You sort of go into the hospital as if, like a car into a mechanics shop, and they'll say, not there's Mr. Jones in room 18, but there's a heart in the room 18, and a liver in room 23, and a gallbladder in room 25. And they think of you in terms of your problems and your organs, but a person is a person. And when you can understand the whole being, medicine is going to make a huge change. Even my nephew, who I just talked about recently, he was visiting me here just the other day, and it was really lovely to see how this younger doctor is so much more sensitively open to alternative kinds of medicine that depend more upon the individual, more upon our ability to respond. Well, so I don't say medicine's wrong. I've had to put myself in the hands of doctors, or I certainly, frankly, wouldn't be here anymore. Too many things have threatened my life that have been saved by medicine. I'm grateful to medicine. But I don't say medicine is the last word. The last word is developing your inner energy, as Master taught us, and through that, to be able to rise above and to cure many things. And in fact, by that energy, I have done much more than doctors have done for me. But the same thing with psychology. Psychologists, now, I want to see how long have I been going at this. Can you tell me, Peter? Sorry for the timeout. I couldn't see in this light. There's another thing is I've just had this eye operation, and where I can see everything beautifully at a distance, it's a little hard to see things close up. But psychology is doing a great thing. However, psychology began with a study of abnormal psychology, and even now it's more concentrated, more concerned with abnormalities, assuming that normality means being just like you and me. It reminds me, when I was in college, my cousin wrote saying that she wanted to become a doctor and help people. And I wrote back and I said that I think that's a wonderful ideal. But as you've written this, and since we're close, you've made me think, what do I want to do with my life? And I realized that I don't want to take sick people and make them well, because I see that when they're well, they're not all that well anyway. I said, I'd rather with my life try to take well people and make them better. Well, psychology doesn't try to do that for you. It tries to work in an intellectual way, with an analytical way. It's much more problem conscious than solution conscious. And it does have its place when people are all screwed up mentally. They need the help of a psychologist. But it's on a small level. You don't see any saints being produced by psychology. Rather, psychoanalysis has produced a lot of people who are over preoccupied with themselves, self-centered, self-involved, self-indulgent, and that's something that yoga needs to help them to get out of. But Ananda, in this whole battle in the courts and so on, we have been practicing spiritual psychology. We have been offering ourselves, our difficulties, our trials up to God and asked Him to enlighten, because real understanding won't come by analysis only. It doesn't come. And I've noticed again and again in my own life that I introspect, and we're supposed to introspect, and I think, well, this, well, that. Ah, now I understand, and it feels great. I've understood something. Tomorrow, what was it I understood? It's never clear. It's just sort of like going from one room of the ego into another room of the ego. You have breakthroughs that prove to be just evanescent. What you're really looking for is understanding, and understanding is not intellectual. Understanding doesn't come from brooding on your difficulties, thinking about the past. Why did this happen? Why did I do that? You need to do that to a certain extent, but the most important thing of all is lift it up to God in prayer and meditation, and all of a sudden the understanding comes. I've mentioned to you that when I was new on the path, I had a lot of struggle with intellectual pride, and I just couldn't overcome it. And I was working with it and trying my best. You have to do your best. That's why I say I don't talk against medicine, I don't talk against psychology. All I want to do is emphasize that it's not enough in itself, and that yoga is much, much more. It's not a total alternative. Those are stepping stones on the path to the same truth, ultimately. But I remember one time in meditation, I was worrying about trying to become humble, and I offered my ego up to God, and suddenly I felt as if through Master's grace and presence, I felt free from ego. That doesn't mean I'm free totally. The struggle goes on all your life, but I did really have a new level of understanding. It wasn't that I understand now because this or because that. I just understood. And the beautiful thing that happened afterwards was that I left my meditation room and I came out and I saw Master there, and I went to him and touched his feet, as was our custom. And he blessed me and tapped me on the head and he said, "Very good." He understood. That's the kind of thing we want. That in all our struggles, instead of just asking why, and hoping to answer it with our minds, offer it to God, and you'll find that all of a sudden, from superconsciousness, or in superconsciousness, even better, but from superconsciousness too, the answer will come to you, and you'll know. In this case, that answer has come to me, that the struggles we've gone through have been a blessing, in the sense that they've helped us to go through the tapasya, to give us the strength to grow in a way that we would not have been able to do otherwise. So I thank God, even with tears of joy, for everything that has happened. It has been His grace and His blessing. God bless you.